Good morning. Thank you all for being here, and thank you to the Philadelphia Society for hosting this debate. I gotta tell you, when I received the email invitation, I was a little bit perplexed to hear that you guys wanted to do a debate on immigration. I mean, really? Since when do we debate immigration in America? Surely this must be a mistake. I mean, even I, a humble immigrant from Quebec, who has not yet fully learned your ways, heck, I barely speak English, even I know full well that there's no debate to be had. The question has long been settled. Everyone's in favor of more immigration. I mean, don't you know that America is not a nation? It's an idea. Ideas have no borders. Ideas are not tied to a particular people or to a place. I guess you could say we are a nation, but then you'd have to qualify it. You'd have to say that we're a universal nation, as Bent Wattenberg used to say. Or we're a propositional nation, as the wise Paul Ryan would explain in defending amnesty and mass immigration. At the very least, I would hope you all know that we're a nation of immigrants. I mean, haven't you read JFK's book? Not Profiles in Courage, the other one, the one he actually wrote, A Nation of Immigrants? I mean, it's right there in the title. Haven't you guys been to the Statue of Liberty? You know, on the pedestal, there's the mission statement for America that's etched on. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. These words were written by the woman who founded America, Emma Lazarus. Okay, I learned this from Jim Acosta. It's true. Look, the more immigration, the better. And the more diverse the immigration, well, that's even better. You know why? Because diversity is our strength. That's what all of the smart people in America are saying, including the smartest one of them all, Barack Obama. He got a Nobel Peace Prize, by the way. Also, isn't this supposed to be some sort of a conservative gathering? Don't you care about preserving America's traditions? We've always had open borders for most of the country's history. Also, don't you care about the Constitution and limited government? There's no enumerated power in the Constitution to regulate immigration. Heck, the word immigration does not appear anywhere in the Constitution. Don't you read the Wall Street Journal? That's the conservative newspaper, you know. They've been proposing this amendment, five simple words: there shall be open borders. And lastly, as conservatives, aren't you supposed to support the Republican Party? In 2012, they put out this awesome report called the RNC Autopsy, and in there, they said that the way to win is, quote, to embrace and champion comprehensive immigration reform. We also believe, they added, that comprehensive immigration reform is consistent with Republican economic policies that promote job growth and opportunity for all. So I return to my initial question. What is there to debate? I mean, I guess there is the very, very bad orange man in the White House. Okay, he has said some horrible things about immigrants. He said that all Mexicans are rapists. He said that we should keep out all Muslims and that every developing country is a shithole. But everyone knows that he's just a racist who was installed by the Russians who stole the election from Hillary Clinton. I mean, I guess, sure, 63 million people voted for him, but they're all deplorables. Look, the bottom line is very simple. Everyone knows that the only people who oppose immigration are nativists, white supremacists, xenophobes, bigots, and racists. Why would anyone want to debate these people? But you did show up, and you were promised a debate, so I guess you should get one, and I'm going to take a crack at it. I'd like to begin by establishing that we are permitted to have this debate, i.e., that America, as a sovereign nation, is allowed to enact whatever immigration policies it wants. We can choose to have open borders, that is indeed permitted, but we can also choose closed borders or anything in between, and we can change our mind at will. Nothing in America, neither its principles nor its constitution, requires open borders. Now, you may say, well, isn't that obvious? But it isn't to Mr. Noraste and his libertarian friends. They claim that our founding principles demand open borders, that a commitment to free markets requires the free movement of peoples, and that, look, if freedom means anything, it means the liberty to go where you please. Allow me then to first dispose of these claims. Let's begin by looking at our founding principles. The clearest and most concise formulation of our founding principles can be found in the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence. There, and by the way, in countless other major public documents of the founding, we learn that America is a natural rights republic. I'm not going to summarize all that this entails. Let me just focus on the two fundamental teachings. The first one is that all human beings, regardless of race, religion, creed, skin color, you name it, are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And the second one is that particular groups of human beings get together and establish a particular government to secure their own rights. In other words, when a group of people decides to form a political community, they set themselves apart from the rest of humanity, and they establish a government that is sovereign over a particular territory. Now, individuals are free to leave a political community as they wish, but, and this is what the libertarians don't understand, they do not have a right to demand admission into another political community. Sovereign nations are free to exclude who they want for whatever reason they want, just as they are free to let in who they want for whatever reason they want. We are not permitted to violate the rights of foreigners, for example, by enslaving them or killing them. But beyond that, we owe them nothing. You need to remember that the Declaration of Independence doesn't begin with the second paragraph. It begins in the first paragraph with what? We, the American people, we are one people, and we are assuming our separate and equal station amongst the powers of the earth. We are setting up a government. Why? To secure, well, it says, their safety and happiness for their and to provide for their future security. What does this mean for immigration? It means that basically immigration, like any other form of policy, has to serve the interests and the well-being of the American people. There are times when we may think it's best to encourage a lot of immigration here. For example, this is what the founders wanted to do. Why? We had a vast continent that needed to be conquered and populated. But circumstances change. We are a sovereign political community, and we are therefore always free to enact whatever immigration measures we deem to be in our national interest. Let me drive home the point as clearly as I can. No one has a right to immigrate to America or to become an American. That is why the same founders who generally supported a more liberal immigration policy at the time never ever endorsed the principle that America should have open borders. Now, you may say, okay, but then why didn't they grant Congress the power to regulate immigration? After all, there is no Article 1, Section 8 power that says the power to make immigration policy. Where is it in the Constitution? Well, in fact, it is there. It's just embedded in another power. It's embedded in the power to define and punish offenses against the laws of nation. The framers derived their understanding of the laws of nation from the foundational works on the subjects by Aymeric de Vattel, William Blackstone, Samuel Pufendorf. And all of them make clear that immigration, because it necessarily involves foreign nationals and foreign governments, falls under the laws of nation. Okay, you'll say, but what about free markets? Isn't it anathema to capitalism to have the state use its coercive powers to artificially restrict the labor supply? Now, this is the classic economic argument that is marshaled by the libertarians. It's in fact their foundational argument. But here is the thing. America is not an economy. It's a country. It's called the United States of America, not the United Markets of America. We go to the marketplace. We don't live in the marketplace. And we are citizens of a republic. We are not Nietzsche's last man, wholly consumed by our pathetic private pleasures. America exists not to maximize GDP or individual autonomy, but, and here I quote the most beautiful line in the Constitution, to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Economic considerations are, of course, very important in making policy, especially in a commercial republic such as ours, but they are not a trump card. A policy may make absolutely no sense economically. For example, putting sanctions on North Korea and Iran and saying you can't trade with them, criminalizing the sale of hard drugs, subsidizing marriage and childbirth. But these may still be politically salutary, even necessary. Economics must be subordinated to statesmanship, to first-order considerations about the health and sustainability of the regime. This is something that libertarians cannot understand, because libertarianism is not a political theory. It is an economic theory masquerading as a political theory. Allow me also, while we're on the subject, to remind you not to put too much stock in the forecast, studies, and statistics and ground pronouncements of the economists. Economics is not a science. Now, I know they've somehow managed to convince the Norwegians to give them a Nobel Prize. The Swedes. But that doesn't make the dismal science a real science. They didn't predict the 2008 crash. They can't even agree on what caused it. Heck, they still don't agree on what caused the 1929 crash. There are major disagreements in the field. There are, by contrast, no ideological schisms or schools in the hard sciences. I've never heard of clear water and saltwater chemists and physicists, for example. That is not to say that all economists are fools and that they have nothing to teach us. I, for one, have learned a lot from reading Hayek, Friedman, and Buchanan. The only point I want to make is that economists should never have the last word in making political decisions. So, having established that we are free to enact whatever immigration policies we choose, let's turn now to the question at hand. Namely, well, what immigration policy should we have in America today? Well, the answer to that is quite obvious, of course, not the one we currently have. Our current immigration system, if you can even call it a system, I think it's more fair to call it an immigration shambles, is an incoherent mess that does not serve the American people well and does not reflect their wishes. We let in too many people, we admit them on the basis of loose family ties and chance rather than skills, and we discourage them from assimilating once they come here. And that's just the legal immigrants. We have another 22 million illegals in the country and thousands more streaming across the southern border every day. We don't enforce our laws. Look, I gotta tell you, as a Canadian who grew up admiring America for being the most powerful, I hesitate to say badass nation in the world, I am in a state of utter disbelief that America allows itself to be humiliated every day by having its laws flaunted with impunity. What does this teach foreigners and citizens alike? That in America, you can make a mockery of our laws and no one cares. America has lost control of its borders. Our immigration system is therefore in need of an overhaul. How should we approach the task? Look, as I look at it, when it comes to immigration, there are really two major questions. The first one is, who do we let in? How many? On what basis? And then the second one is, what do we expect of them once they've arrived? I want to begin with the second question because it's easier to answer, and it also sets a limit to the first question. Immigration must go hand in hand with patriotic assimilation. They're really two sides of the same coin. The founders were quite clear on this, and I think we should heed their wise counsel. Robert, can you pass me the water, please? Thank you. For the founders, unity, not diversity, would be our strength. They wanted immigrants to come to America, but they expected them to forswear all foreign allegiances, to learn English, to adopt our way of life, to profess devotion to our Republican principles, to marry our sons and daughters, and eventually one day to disappear into the population at large. Here is how the father of our great nation, George Washington, once put it. By an intermixture with our people, they or their descendants get assimilated to our customs, measures, and laws. In a word, they soon become one people. To strengthen the ties that bind all Americans, immigrant and native born alike, into one people, that was their goal, and that should remain our goal today. Without patriotic assimilation, America ceases to be a coherent, unified country. It is reduced to a disunited, loose confederation of squabbling tribes. Now, there was a time when this was not an issue in America, because all of us believed in America, and all of us believed that immigrants had to embrace it. But we no longer have the self-confidence we once did. We are no longer sure that our way of life is better. In fact, our elites are convinced that it's reprehensible, that we're sexist, that we're racist, that we're homophobes, that we're soulless consumerists. Our schools, to say nothing of our universities, no longer teach children to love our country. They teach them to despise it. Howard Zinn, not Paul Johnson, is regrettably our national historian. To make things worse, we actually promote the very opposite of patriotic assimilation. Because of the cancerous spread of identity politics in America, immigrants are taught to think of themselves as oppressed minorities. We are all hyphenated Americans, and what matters is what comes before the hyphen. Immigrants, like native-born Americans for that matter, also soon learn about all of the benefits, from affirmative action to government contracting set-asides for minority-owned businesses, that come from not assimilating. Let me share with you an anecdote. When Nixon's OMB created the racial hexagon and cooked up these categories that we think by today, they put in Indians from the seven continent. They were classified as Oriental Americans, or as we call them today, Asians, since that is no longer the preferred nomenclature, if there are any Big Lebowski fans in the audience. But then the Indians and the Pakistani came here, and the government was telling them they're white, but they realized that there's something called low-interest loans for minority-owned businesses. So they petitioned the Reagan administration to be reclassified as Asians. I'm sorry, I think I misexplained it. They were classified as Caucasians racially. They petitioned the government to be reclassified as Asians because they wanted the loans. The Reagan administration obliged. So much for white privilege. The point is, the obstacles to patriotic assimilation are greater today than they have ever been. This should give us pause, and I want to make one thing clear. The fault lies primarily with us rather than with the immigrants. I also think that the unprecedented levels of immigration to America in the past 50 years should also give us pause. Since we enacted the Hart-Celler Act in 1965, the last major overhaul of immigration, do you know how many immigrants have come to America? About 60 million. That is the largest migration in recorded human history. As a result, the share of Americans today who are foreign-born is the largest that it's been in over a century. It's at almost 14%. About one in four people in the country today are either themselves foreign-born or the children of immigrants. And that number is set to increase exponentially in the years to come. Why? Because we haven't just had the largest migration in American history and in world history, it hasn't stopped. It's been ongoing. Each year, about 1.5 million people move to the country. Think of the last major massive wave of immigration we had in America, from about Reconstruction until the beginning of World War I. That was followed by a very long lull, a 40-year period from 1924 until 1965, where we had considerably less immigration. And this gave the immigrants time to assimilate. It gave America time to make them into Americans. It allowed the Irish, the Italians, and the Eastern Europeans to become Americans. It also really helped, by the way, that at the time there was no internet, there was no affordable long-distance calls, and there was no cheap air travel. When you left for good. Today, by contrast, immigrants can remain connected to their homelands thanks to the wonders of modern technology. What's more, our policies ensure that there's a constant flow of new immigrants that come and reinforce existing immigrant communities, which means that people can more easily withdraw into their own ethnic communities. And so, with each passing year, the idea of a unified we the people grows weaker and weaker. None of this is meant to suggest that we should no longer accept immigrants. My point is simply to impress upon you the concrete circumstances we live in today that make it considerably more difficult to assimilate immigrants than in the past. So who then should we let in as immigrants? I mean, this is not a policy debate. I don't want to get into the weeds. I want to keep it pretty general. And I say we should let in the right kind of immigrants, which is, again, the way I think that the founders thought about it. We should want healthy, industrious immigrants of good character who will contribute to our country's strength and prosperity and assimilate to its way of life. Look, the basic thing when you're thinking about immigration policy is to ask yourself one simple question. Is this good for America and Americans? You do not ask, is this good for the immigrants? The one exception would be refugee policy. We can perhaps discuss that in the Q&A, and even there, I think we can think about it in a better way. I think we should privilege immigrants who speak English, who are younger rather than older, who are well-educated, who bring with them capital to invest, who possess extraordinary abilities, and we should exclude people who threaten our safety, who do not obey our laws, who are likely to become dependent wards of the state. And we should always be mindful of the obstacles that exist today to assimilation. I'll end by saying this. I began my remarks in a snarky way by expressing my disbelief that we were having this debate. I'd like to do so again in closing, but this time for other reasons. How can anyone take seriously the claim that we should have something approaching open borders, as Mr. Noraste is about to argue? Can you imagine how the founders would react to the proposition that America, a sovereign country whose independence they had fought to secure with their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor, should not have borders? That anyone should just be permitted to settle here? That the American people should have no say in the matter? That the whole of humanity possesses a God-given right to inhabit America? I challenge anyone in the audience to find a single serious statesman or political theorist or philosopher who has ever endorsed open borders. You won't, because it is an utterly unserious idea. In fact, it is an idea so silly that only ideologues, libertarians, progressives, and economists could ever entertain it seriously. Thank you.